I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
Back in June of 2020, Dr. Rachel Lance was on the show to talk about her book, In the Waves, detailing the H.L. Hunley disaster. And today she is back to grace us again, this time talking about her new book, Chamber Divers.
Chamber Divers is about World War II and the team of British geneticists that was tasked with solving the problem of how to get military personnel to survive underwater. It is a roller coaster of a story that was classified for a very long time.
So it was an absolute delight for me to pepper her with questions about this team of very unique and daring scientists and how their work has informed entire fields of science. So here is that conversation. All right, today I am lucky enough to be joined by Dr. Rachel Lance, who has been on the show before, but last time Tracy got to hoard you all to herself, and now I get my chance.
We've made our purple hair connection.
We have. So welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
Oh, I'm so glad. Because you have a new and quite impressive book out, Chamber Divers, which is, we'll get into it, but some of this is a very harrowing read in the best way. But the first thing I want to talk to you about is that even more than your first book, which was In the Waves, this book seems to me, knowing you a bit, to be so deeply in your wheelhouse and sort of where you might have been headed before you started researching the sinking of the Hunley in the Civil War and what informed that first book. Does this feel like the inevitable book that you were going to eventually write?
It feels like another story that was weirdly just waiting for me. That was how I felt with the Hunley. I was like, who arranged this? This feels like a conspiracy. And I feel like this one was true, too. And what I decided is that that's what I think makes engaging books, is when people write what they know and they write the stories that they're the best person to tell. And so this book came out of a paper that I read during the course of my Hunley research. And it was this group of researchers who were doing some stuff with carbon dioxide. And the date bothered me. It was 1941. It was published in 1941. And they were in England. So in research, papers take a long time to come out. So it usually means that you've done the work the year before. And that means that they were doing research on carbon dioxide during the Blitz in 1940. And I could not figure out why people who were literally being bombed in their homes would care about carbon dioxide. It seemed really irrelevant at that time period. So I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And I kept digging and digging. And so this was the story that I eventually uncovered. And it was too good not to write. It was too good.
The other thing that I want to talk to you about a little bit is your research and writing process, but specifically because this book, your work on it, straddled the pandemic. Some of it happened before we knew that the world was going to fall apart for a little while, and some of it happened after. And there are some pretty interesting moments in the text where you include comparisons of things like medical issues and people's behavior during World War II to what we have just experienced with COVID.
Right.
So aside from the obvious impediments to research that came up while we all had to sit in our homes, how much did the COVID-19 pandemic inform the way that you processed the information that you were researching as you were prepping and writing Chamber Divers?
It was really important to me personally because I was a high-risk person. I'm a high-risk medical person. And I had made the decision to have a really critical knee surgery in January 2020. My logic was, okay, I've got to head to London. I've got to do all this research, but London is a walking city. I'll get this knee surgery done first, and then I'll be more comfortable walking, because that didn't work out great for me. So I was trying to write whatever other bits and pieces I could do. It meant that I had to reconfigure the organization and timeline of how I wrote the whole book. And it also meant that since someone who is not only high risk, but works at a hospital in respiratory physiology research, I was going through my personal experiences as well. So I'm a PhD. I don't treat medical patients. All of research was shut down, but this is still my crew at work, right? Like, these are still my people there. And this was a respiratory disease. And so that, and at the time I was married to a firefighter who was doing a lot of CPR on people with respiratory failure and coming home at the end of that. And so that was a really big part of my life for at least the first full year, for sure. Longer than that in reality. And one of the chapters that I wrote during this, because I could do a lot of the research using digitized sources, was the Blitz chapter. That chapter, which I believe is chapter 5, it might have gotten renumbered, but it kind of became a form of therapy for me as I was writing it. There was a lot that got cut out of there because I would read all these diaries where people were acting exactly like they were in the pandemic. And I was just sitting there like, oh my God, there's nothing we could do. There's nothing we could do to inform people and like educate them properly in a way that everyone is feeling comfortable with the actions we need to take together. And it really hammered home for me in kind of a depressing way how much we're restricted by our nature and the way our brains process information. So like I said, a lot of that ended up getting cut out, but writing it and at least putting it down was a big way that I was processing what was happening in our world at the time.
Yeah, I was so struck by the segments in that chapter where you're talking about how people living outside of London are sort of like, la, 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 la. It feels very distant to them, this idea that their countrymen are literally living through hell. And the people leaving London for respite are like almost in a different flavor of like cultural shell shock because no one understands where they're at mentally. That to me was super fascinating.
That's exactly why I put that in there. I'm glad you picked up on that because that was the experience that I was having, even with some family members, where they were living a life that felt completely disconnected from what was happening. And that made it easier for them to fail to process the severity of what the rest of us were going through.
So wild.
Yeah. It was really interesting how many parallels there were. I went through a lot of diaries for that chapter, a lot of Blitz diaries.
Yeah.
So
this is also an interesting tale because it involves a lot of information that was classified for a very long time.
Yes.
So you mentioned that it came to your attention because you read a paper, but how did you actually get to the point where you were getting the real information you needed to put this story together? Like, at what point were you like, is this hidden information? Can I have this?
That's you kind of just have to play stupid with the government. That's the best way. You kind of have to. No, it's exactly like you said. You kind of just have to be like, can I have it? And if they'll give it to you, they'll give it to you. So classified documents, you're either going to get everything you want with no fight, or there is no negotiation and you will never see it. Those are the two extremes. So with these, since it relates to World War II, what these researchers were working on ultimately ended up being the landings at D-Day. The landings at D-Day were highly classified for a really long time, even after they were successful, because the techniques that were developed were so new. So what had to happen in order for these documents to be declassified is the governments involved, the governments of all the allied countries, had to go through and be like, yes, it's public knowledge that we do this. So it not only had to be no longer relevant to the landings themselves, but it had to be that the techniques that had been created specifically for D-Day were now considered public information.
Gotcha.
A lot of those had not been declassified by the British until the late 1970s. In America, some of them were classified until the early 2000s. And then there were others still that I had to request the release for. And I had to, when I requested them, I sort of made the argument of like, everyone knows you're doing this anyway. So, but also there's a guessing game involved as well, because it's classified. So you can't justify why you need the thing, because you can't read the thing in order to know that it says what you need it to say. So you kind of have to play this game where you're like, this is just titled Report 1943. Might it contain the solution to all of my problems? I don't know, but I'm going to try and read it. And so a lot of this is brute force method. There's very much this brute force methodology of setting aside hours, days, preferably a couple weeks for each archive, and then just committing yourself to the fact that you live there for a little while and may not. Yeah. Like I get so invested in these documents when I'm finally able to access them, because they're all physical. These are not digitized, that I'm like actively annoyed by my need to use the restrooms. I'm just right. Like, damn it, bladder, not again. So, yeah. And then you got to just power through. That's what that process looks like.
So what is the hit rate? Like what percentage of stuff are you like, this actually is not relevant to my deal at all, versus the amount where you're like, Eureka, I've got something really cool?
I do have an archive stance. It's very quiet and contained, so I don't get kicked out. but I do. The hit rate is pretty low. But what's interesting is that the best jewels are the ones you don't expect to find.
Right.
The best jewels are the ones where you go in and you're saying, okay, I don't know exactly what this story is. And that's very much how Chamber Divers came together. It started with that one paper. And I was like, I don't know what this story is, but something was going on. And so I create a master timeline document. So by the end of writing this book, my master timeline document was over 80 pages long. And as I'm doing that, I kind of just fill in the key events as I'm finding them. Because when you're reading these papers, you're also not necessarily getting them in chronological order, right? You don't know what you're going to find when you ask for it. So I create this document and I keep citations to where I found each fact and what date it occurred on. And by the end, I've got the story. And so the hit rate seems like it's really low, but there's a high rate of finding things that are really cool that you don't expect. Like the admission that the divers used to just pee in their suits because they found them annoying to take off. I was like, yeah, this is going in the book. So
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
This is so fascinating to me. But I want to get to the actual meat of the book and what it contains, because you open with a very detailed description of what we now know today as Operation Jubilee, which is the landing at Dieppe that took place in 1942. Will you talk a little bit about why that event is so important to setting up the story of the chamber divers?
I wanted to start with that event because I think we tend to focus on D-Day without necessarily looking at the planning that went into it. We talk a lot about Omaha Beach, what went wrong in Omaha Beach, and we do a good job as a society of honoring those who gave up their lives. What I really wanted to do with this book was tell the story of what went right and how lives were saved. And so the information to do that requires first setting up what happens if there isn't planning, what happens if there isn't beach scouting, what happens if we don't know how to send divers, which is what the chamber divers were eventually working on. So I wanted to start with Dieppe in 1942 because that was an example of a kind of comparable beach landing to Normandy. And it was one where they didn't have these scouting methods in advance. They didn't have these tools like the mini subs and the rebreathers that these experimentalists were working on. And it was an absolute bloodbath. On Blue Beach alone, which is one of the beaches, the casualty rates were at 97%. So basically no one made it off that beach. And that was a direct result of the lack of advanced information. So I wanted to use that. The book starts with Dieppe and it ends with D-Day. And the goal there was to kind of bracket this lack of planning and lack of detailed scouting information versus what can happen when you have that, when you've done your scientific background research.
Then the book jumps back in time a little bit because you start to introduce your cast of characters that emerge throughout the early chapters, which is like, I really want this to be made into a movie just so that I can see the Ocean's 11 style accumulation of like brains and really eccentric characters, etc. And I know that you have also said in interviews and even on our show when we had you on before that when people talk about any kind of scientific or research work, there is always a team. And this team was really extraordinary. Will you talk a little bit about some of the members of this incredible pros and cons grade team of people?
Yes, pros and cons. That's a good way to put it. I think what you're referring to is the fact that I just tried to be really honest about everyone. We're entering a new age of history where we're no longer just looking at people as like bronze figures up on weird horse statues. We're trying to like talk about people as more complete human beings. Mm-hmm. And none of us are perfect. Ourselves included. But like, so I wanted to present these characters as like complete and well-rounded, including their flaws, people. So one of my favorite people in the book is this woman, Dr. Helen Spurway. And she was this known for being socially awkward PhD geneticist who really love newts and salamanders. And so she shows up to class on the first day at University College London, and she just like casually announces to everyone that she's going to marry the professor, who, by the way, is already married. So this is a daring, this is not the way to make friends. But
read the room, Helen.
Exactly. She turns out to be like a really good scientist. This woman can do anything with statistics and math. And she's also like so invested in using statistics and math to track your genetics that she'll just like go up to random people's houses if they have a pond in their backyard and knock on their door and be like, "Hi, my name is Helen. Can I look in your pond for salamanders?" And like, this is how she got her data. She was tracking the characteristics of salamanders and newts across her area of England. And this turned into academic papers because that is actually how genetics was studied at the time. So this is a group of people who, because of their field, are inherently used to bucking a little bit of authority. They're used to being considered a little bit odd. And I use that word lovingly because I myself am a minorly odd scientist. So, and then you also have a lot of them who came over from Germany.
Yeah.
The lab leader, JBS Haldane, he is an ancestrally wealthy, privileged white man. But because he went through a lot of extreme bullying when he was younger, he always considers himself kind of an underdog. And he always fights for other underdogs. And he also, like, he has this incredible temper that he becomes infamous for. But he's also just sitting there like, why is racism a thing? This doesn't make any sense. It's just genetic variation in skin pigment. So, like, he's got this mixture of being incredibly egalitarian that I think is to his credit. And so when refugees start coming out of Germany, he starts saying like, oh my gosh, I'm going to fund as many as possible. This is dumb. Judaism is not a genetic flaw. This doesn't make scientific sense. So he starts trying to fund them. And that becomes a huge component of his lab. One of the other people that I really loved was Ursula Philipp. I related to her because one of the first things that her daughter told me when I interviewed her is that she used to always spill food on herself. And I was like, me too.
Yeah.
Me too, Ursula. I see you, girl. So, yeah, she was also a spectacular geneticist, ends up being a key part of this research, puts herself in these experiments, puts herself at incredible risk for this country where she's a refugee. So
I love it. Listen, later on, maybe offline, we can talk about how Martin Case is my new history crush, but that's a different matter.
You'll have to fight me for him.
I mean, he's so my flavor. He's a little bit wacky, devil may care, cute as pie, super smart. Come on. The dream.
Oh my gosh. I interviewed his niece, and the first time I interviewed his niece on the Zoom, because England is 6 hours ahead, she just like chimes in and then raises up her cocktail. I was like, oh gosh.
It's genetic.
I'm friends with you now. Yeah.
Oh yeah, because there's a lot of drinking in this book as well. But I'm glad that you mentioned the sort of egalitarian approach to bringing on team members, particularly people that had fled, because you mention in the book that several of these scientists were people that were eventually going to be targeted if they weren't already when they left, you know. And this is, of course, when the eugenics movement has its own balloon of support.
Dark festivities.
Right. There's also a great moment where you're talking about Ursula and sort of the legend of her fleeing Germany versus the reality not really being quite so dramatic. So one, I would love for you to talk about that correction in particular because it's so charming to me. And two, I also like would love to hear more about kind of the outsider status, even in Britain, where that's theoretically not playing out, but it is impacting how they're accepted and how they're perceived.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Again, Ursula, I just want to be her friend. Before this book, there is very little known about her. She wasn't given credit for a lot of her achievements. A lot of what she had achieved in Germany before she fled was then destroyed and tried to cover by the Nazis because they didn't like that a woman did it. Not great inequality, those Nazis. And so one of the stories about her that has been repeated in secondary and tertiary sources is that she graduated and defended her PhD and then had to flee like immediately, as in she basically defended her PhD on the run and then had to flee, and she didn't get a chance to get her physical doctorate paper, which of course in the 1930s is a lot more important because there's no digital verification of degrees, right? So I tried to track this back to its original source and I couldn't find it. So when I was talking to her daughter, I kind of bring this up and her daughter just starts laughing. She goes, "That wasn't true." I was like, "What really happened?" She goes, "She just forgot it." Again, girl, I see you. I relate to you so hard.
Super important document. Just left it behind. It happened.
Spectacular at science, not amazing at life logistics. And this is me. This is So I really wanted to include that as another example, right? Like, we don't have to talk about people as if they're perfect, shiny emblems. We can talk about people as if they're realistic. And that also makes science more accessible, in my opinion.
Yes.
If you're someone who, in your regular life, you occasionally leave your doctorate behind because you've forgotten it. Like, you could still be amazing at science. So when Ursula Philipp and the other Jewish refugee scientists came over, the two of whom who are in the book are Hans Kalmus and Hans Grüneberg. Mm-hmm. They came over to this UCL lab. They were given refuge there and they were given a salary and their families were brought over. So all of them were saved and most of their relatives ended up being murdered in the Holocaust. So they were very clearly saved by this, and they were experiencing this in a lab where within the internal lab walls, they seem to have been treated as equals, at least as far as I can tell. And their communications from the time period are very honest. So they seem to have been treated as equals. But outside, the rest of the world was still kind of brewing with anti-Semitism. One of the things I really tried to do when I wrote this book was to give every action a context, because I think that's the true story of science. It's, why did people work on this now? Why did people care about this now? What was it like for the individuals doing it? And so I dedicated some time in one of the earlier chapters to, after they come through and they're in London, there are riots in the street. There were literal physical riots in the streets of London outside the campus walls over Judaism, communism, fascism, kind of all of these ideas that we know in a couple of years will turn into literal war during World War II. And so they were kind of in this little bubble where they'd been given an opportunity to get out of the most extreme anti-Semitism, but we're still in a context where they were fighting for a country where there were layers of discrimination.
This makes it so fascinating because they go through so much in the service of creating this, really doing all of this research on this project and creating solutions to problems that help everyone, even though everyone has not been cool to them. one of the sort of two of the things that you mentioned early on as the top of those lists of problems that this assembled team worked on were carbon dioxide and decompression sickness. And one of the things that I really enjoy about your writing is that you, and I've told you this before and I think it embarrassed you, is that you parse science in a way that normies like myself, who love science but sometimes grapple with understanding it, will get it, and it like opens these doors. So I would love for you to explain in layman's terms why it is so critical to understand these things in a wartime situation or any underwater situation and other situations, so that it makes a little easier sense. And some of it, I think, is stuff that doesn't make it to layman because, frankly, the times it has gone wrong have been horrific and nobody wants to really get into it.
Right. Okay. So you didn't embarrass me. I appreciate the compliment. But I think what I took opposition to is the word normies, because
I mean, in my that's a very opinion, flexible term in my world.
Yeah. No, but in my opinion, science is for everyone. And if you are not a professional scientist, the only thing that's usually missing is the daily vocabulary. Every profession has their daily vocabulary of terms. And just because you don't know all of those doesn't mean you're stupid. Like, or it doesn't mean you're less intelligent or whatever. So, one of my major goals is to just be like, listen, you don't know the word, and that's that's fine. This isn't your daily job. I don't know the daily words and terminology of your job either.
Me either.
So, yeah. That's a separate conversation.
Right.
So one of the things that I really try to do is emphasize not only what these people are doing, who they are, but also why this problem is important and why it's so challenging. This is something that I began to appreciate as a scientist myself, because I get a lot of questions about, well, why can't they do this? Why can't they do that? Or why can't they just make a thing? And I'm like, first of all, who is they? So be more specific.
The grand poobah of science.
Yeah. Because we can. The question is, how much money are you willing to contribute to our salaries? Unfortunately, at this point in my life, no one has yet given me the vast sums of money it would require for me to do science for free. So because I do have a mortgage, I do have to buy food.
What?
And that's just, yeah, it's one of the sad limitations of my life situation.
Spoiled.
Right. So like most other scientists, we have to have funding just because as much as we love this stuff, like we still have to survive. And so we have to have funding to pay our salaries in buy equipment and buy lab space and things like that. So if someone is not willing to invest in a thing, then we really have a hard time achieving it for those practical life limitations. Yeah. So I wanted to emphasize not only what the people were doing, but how complex some of these problems are.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
So, will you explain, though, why carbon dioxide and decompression sickness are such huge issues, and why at this point in time people were like, I don't know what's going on. These guys did not make it. We're trying to figure it out.
Okay. So the big question is the ending of what you just said. Why people are like, I don't know. We all experienced this. This ties back in the pandemic. Everyone experienced this in the non-scientific world real time during the pandemic. In science, if you're talking about sickness, you're talking about death, you're talking about injury, anything that happens to human beings, we don't know anything until it starts happening to someone. We can do tests for years in petri dishes or whatever, and it's still not going to be the same as putting a person through it. I can put a petri dish in a car seat all you want, but it's not going to tell me when someone's going to die in a car crash. So unfortunately, a lot of the data that we get in all these scenarios comes because someone got hurt. or someone got sick or someone died. And we're not going to do that on purpose. I'm never going to blow someone up on purpose. So my data from blasts, for example, comes from when people have gotten blown up by accident. So what we saw in the pandemic was that being worked out real time with an illness where we're like, we don't know yet. We're waiting for this to spread. We have to see how this happens naturally because we can't ethically do this on purpose. And that was the same thing that was happening with diving and DCS. So with diving and decompression sickness, DCS, otherwise known as the bends, this just started happening. It was a thing happening to bridge construction workers. And people were like, we don't know. We're going to try a couple things. Most of those things are not going to work. Eventually, one will. And eventually, the one that really did work was invented or thought up by JBS Haldane's father, John Scott Haldane, which is how JBS kind of got into diving. So he looked at the idea of decompression. So he looked at the idea of how to plan your decompression so that you can avoid the disease in the first place. And he kind of was one of the first pioneers of the field to understand that the human body needs time to process what's happening to it underwater.
I'm going to come back to science in a little bit. But first, I kind of want to talk about Haldane because he's a doozy of a character. yeah. One of the issues that comes up in the book is communism, because he was very bought into that movement for a long time.
He was bought into everything. Whatever he liked, he was like, 100% this.
Yes. Yeah. No halfsies.
No middle. Yeah.
Yeah, like the propaganda that was coming out of communist Russia convinced him. Will you talk a little bit about the part that affiliation with communism plays in his life story?
Yes. So he bought into communism, and this was really common in the 1930s. So I tried to be clear about that in the book. Like, now it's considered a bit of a fringe and extremist belief. That's because now we have the example of what really happened in communism.
Right.
They did not have that yet. It was still pretty theoretical. And the Russians, this early Soviet experiment was essentially lying to the rest of the world. And they were lying well. They convinced a lot of people. So for JBS Haldane, he looked at communism as a way to fight fascism. You have this fascist idea that one person should really be in charge, and then you have this communist idea that the people should be in charge. And because he really opposed fascism, he had been in World War I. He'd been in the trenches in World War I. And he had seen what happens when essentially monarchs are able to pit their people against each other at will. He became very anti-individualistic government control. And then he ends up going to the Spanish Civil War voluntarily. And that's where I think he really got radicalized, because he was fighting with the communists against the fascist regimes. So when World War II starts to break out and everything starts to rumble, this is all coming in the context of right after the Great Depression. So you have this guy who's not only been in these wars led by these monarchical and fascist dictators, you have this world that's going through this massive depression where there are food riots and starvation and lots of problems that people are saying, oh, well, theoretically, this could be fixed by communism, which we now know it doesn't. But at that time, very appealing. So he kind of becomes a big part of this. And that really starts to inform his perspective in terms of science. There's a lot of evidence that he did this in part because the communists were saying, oh, well, this is the application of science to help people. And that was a thing he really cared about. Like, he really cared about using science to help people. That was one of his major goals. And so that's how communism and science really tied together for him. And that's a big part of, I think, what motivated the lab to do this stuff. He knew what war was like, and he wanted to help end it. So,
I'm still going to want to talk about Haldane, because he was, I don't know if rebellious is the right word, or just... he saw his path and he knew what he believed was right and what wasn't. And a lot of that led to things like clashes with his bosses and the leadership at University College London. Will you talk a little bit? Because there are some very funny stories about, like, the ways he got around wartime regulations and how he would have visitors get onto campus and into the lab. Like, that cracked me up.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love those stories too. Right. So when the war starts really brewing, the leadership of University College London, UCL, starts to say, okay, we got to shut this down. We got to get people out. We're downtown. They do turn out to be right. They're a little bit early, but Haldane is like, nah, no thanks. I've been bombed several times before. I'm going to keep researching. So like, that's how much this guy cares about genetics. He's like, no, bombs are cool. I'm going to keep working. And he essentially, whenever he has visitors, he tells them to lie and pretend they're from the government, to how to get around the guards at the gates. And he's like, developed secret passageways in, things like this. So this is what he's doing along with his fellow rebellious lab mates in order to keep the research going. Part of the reason I wanted to include that was because that actually doesn't seem that unusual to me. You would be surprised how many scientists I've seen with similar behaviors where they really care about their research to the point where they're like, no, I'll evacuate when the fire gets to me.
Right. Right.
So I thought that was maybe unusual for most people, but very classic scientist.
I sort of love it. Yeah. I think one of them was that he told friends to say they were from the Ministry of Food, which to me is just the nuttiest and best. It's like sneaking. That's a great restaurant name if anybody wants to take it.
I will go to that.
This is interesting, right? Because he's running this lab. There's a lot of genetics research going on, but then they're also being tasked by the government to figure out these issues that are going on with military operations. And then the Blitz is happening in London, where all of this research is underway. So will you talk about sort of the immediacy of the military research at that point and how they stayed focused on things as bombings are literally happening in the city? And then, of course, they eventually had to move. And thank goodness they did.
Oh, finally. Oh, my gosh. So, okay. This was so crazy. I can't even imagine what this would have been like. They know that war is coming, and the Allied militaries have this collective gut-clenching moment in the summer of 1939, where they know that Hitler is bad, and they're like, we're going to start preparing for that. We think this is going to get worse. And they start building more submarines. What starts happening is they have three sinkings in a row. Within 3 weeks of each other, USS Squalus goes down during a training accident. HMS Thetis goes down during a training accident. And the French Feigny, which actually still is lost off the coast of Vietnam, that's a whole side story, goes down during a training accident. But collectively, these countries must have been panicking, and they kept it out of the news. So this context has been left out of a lot of World War II histories, but I can only imagine the panic when they realize that they don't actually know what they're doing underwater. They have no idea how to actually keep people alive in submarines, much less get them out. The Haldane and the UCL group are geneticists by training, and they start working on this problem immediately. And they start doing it on themselves, of course, because they're there. They're human beings. They're handy. This makes sense to a scientist. So as soon as Haldane testifies in the hearing about what happened with the HMS Thetis, he shows up there. He's literally there the day after he's done this trial on himself. So he's still got a migraine from all the CO2. He's just spent the previous night projectile vomiting through the evening. And he gets up there and they ask him to do math. And he does math in front of everyone on the stand to tell them how much carbon dioxide absorbent they would have needed to save their submariners. At that point, the Admiralty goes, and you can feel it in the documents. They don't say it this way, but this is how I mention it. They're like, this is the guy. So they basically just start piling it on him. They're like, here's our list of questions. I've read these list of questions. Some of them we're still working on as scientists. So 80 years later, we're still working on these. What the UCL lab does is basically find this lab with chambers. They go to the hyperbaric chambers, which are large metal tubes that can hold in pressure so they can simulate diving. And they say, okay, this is an emergency. We're being told to evacuate. People are leaving the city. We're expecting bombings any day. this is part of the war we are about to be in. And so they start putting their own bodies in the tubes to test this Admiralty's list of questions. Now, of course, we already talked about Dieppe. 1942, Dieppe happens. That list of questions kind of morphs a little bit. Before, it had been focused a lot on submarines and maybe making mini submarines. And Hal Dane himself had been pushing this idea of free swimming divers. But he didn't really get the Admiralty's full attention until Dieppe in 1942, when they were like, oh, man, we need people underwater. At the time period, diving really meant surface applied diving. So think Cuba Gooding Jr., Men of Honor. That's what it looked like. Giant ship over you. People would be shooting at that. So if you try and scout a beach with it, it's pretty obvious. So what they were doing was really working on the first scouting divers. And they were just in a frenzy for the next several years, trying to come up with the safety limits for how people could do this without dying.
Astonishing.
It just kept getting piled on.
You mentioned that they were themselves test subjects. These are, to me, some of the most terrifying passages of the book, because I'm a wuss and I don't enjoy discomfort of any flavor. But it's one of those things where I'm like, I understand that this approach led to a much deeper understanding of all of this science and asphyxiation and specifically what could happen in submarines. Is this really a good way to do experiments?
What's the alternative?
Right.
No, seriously, what's the alternative?
I mean, that's the thing. It's like you can't ask a mouse how it felt, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
But I do wonder, because I know you do lots of testing and it's very careful and regulated. And obviously, like, there's no way, as you said, to do the things they were doing without putting themselves through it. But were there any instances of this approach where you were like, they have gone too far? This was nope. You should not have done that, sir. I mean, we'll talk more about all of the injuries, but
knowing what I know now, it's impossible for me to evaluate their experiences because my knowledge is based on what they did.
Oh, yeah.
Our entire field, my entire professional field is based on what this group did during World War II. But it was so classified, my entire professional field is going to be finding out this story from this book too. None of us knew. I had to dig it out. So I can look back now and say, yes, if someone today did that, I would punch them in the face because that's insane. But I know that because this group did it. When I was writing it, I'm very flattered you found it terrifying because
great.
I'm glad I could chill you to your core. Because what I wanted to do was convey what they would have experienced. They were getting in this tube. It was tiny. It was thick metal. They had no real way of communicating with the outside except for scribbling notes and holding them up to the very small window. There was no lighting inside. It would have been dark. It would have been loud. And they had no way to get out in case of an emergency because you're under pressure. You can't just come back up. Right. You're going to all get DCS. So I really wanted to convey how terrifying that would have been as an exploration. Now when we do it, we have prescribed guidelines. I can do things safely because of this group. When they were doing that, every single time they closed that chamber door, they had no idea what was about to happen to their bodies. And I really tried to convey that through putting in a sampling of the experiments. So yeah, there are some experiments in there where everything is fine. Everyone comes out and they have a nice afternoon and then they eat sandwiches. And there are other experiments in there where, like, it's really bad. People could have died. So they had no idea going in.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
There are very real negative repercussions to their work. Will you talk about some of the physical damage that some of these researchers ended up with? I was so squinked out by the lit cigarette test that was done. I don't even know how to describe the contortions my body went through, which was Jim Rendell, right?
Yes. Would you like me to talk about that one?
Sure.
Okay.
You could use a couple if you have two that aren't, you know, too so horrifyingly graphic.
Yesterday, I spent a lengthy amount of time explaining the concept of lung butter to someone, so I have no problem being graphic. Yeah, you'll have to tell me what your limit is. Jim Rendell, full name James, but went by Jim. He was a PhD geneticist, and I love this guy because he's a tall person like me. And so he curls up in the chamber one day, and he's going down there, and everything seems fine. So he has a successful test. He's a little bit of trouble clearing his ears, meaning equalizing with the pressure changes, just like on an airplane. But other than that, everything seems okay. So he comes up and he just has this weird chest pain. Like, it's really small. It's just bothering him. He assumes that someone gave him a problematic meat pie, which I just love that he blamed the meat pie. He's like, no, I just ate a weird thing. It keeps getting worse. So eventually he goes to the doctor. The doctor just slices him open between his ribs, and he notices that Jim Rendell's entire lung has collapsed. So what's occurred is there was some pocket of gas in his lung, and as they were coming up from depth, the gas was trapped and it couldn't fully expand. Now, this doesn't usually happen. This is not a normal thing, but some people have flukes of physiology. If he maybe had tuberculosis or another major respiratory disease where there was scarring in his lung, that could happen. It's not extremely common, but it is a thing that exists. And so as he was going up, that gas couldn't expand. He couldn't exhale it, and it ruptured into his chest instead. It'll go somewhere. The laws of physics always win. And so as every time he breathed in, a little bit of his breath would go out through that same rupture and go more into his chest cavity. Eventually, the bubble in his chest cavity grew bigger than his lungs. It collapsed his lungs and it started shoving his heart to the side. So if he'd kept breathing that way, his heart would have been pushed so far to the side that it could have ruptured one of the major blood vessels and he would have bled to death internally. Thankfully, he went to the doctor before he reached that part. They made a small incision in his back, looked around, said, hey, this is a problem. But to test it and make sure that the lung was closed before they sewed him back up, the doctor hands him a lit cigarette and says, hey, kids, smoke this. Not the actual dialogue, but definitely how I imagine it. And so this is a leak test, right? You can see smoke.
Yeah.
So if he inhales on this cigarette and smoke comes into this hole in his chest wall, now we know that the lung isn't sealed. Thankfully for Jim Rendell, no smoke entered his chest cavity. It turned out the lung was fully sealed and they could just kind of purge that gas that was in there, let the lung reinflate, and then sew him back up. But this would keep being a problem for him for the rest of his life. Now this is a fixable problem. There are better ways to attach the lung to the chest wall, but those are more modern inventions than his time period. So this is a thing he struggled with for the rest of his life. He was permanently disabled by this injury.
Yeah, and that's one of the more minor injuries that you describe in this book.
Yeah.
There are ways in which this obviously risk-embracing team's personalities, and particularly Haldane's, from my perception, and correct me if I'm wrong, seem like they had the potential to really mess with Data. Because there's one story where you note that after Haldane was obviously incapacitated during a test, in which he also became violent, he insisted after it was all over that he had never lost consciousness, even though they were like, yes, you did. We watched you. This to me is so fascinating in a scientist. Like, there's some weird hubris in the mix. And your depiction of him is really unflinching because you do show both his positive and negative traits. We talked about that a little bit earlier. But did any of his behaviors kind of come as a surprise to you where you're like, dude, you are a mess?
Honestly, not really. Like, scientists are a quirky group, man. We're just a quirky group. And I love us. I'm a scientist. But I found his behavior to be both problematic in the way that he would have explosions, but in that sense, endearing, because I really related to what I assume. And again, this is an assumption on my part, but what I assume were blowups caused by inability to connect and communicate with other people in what's considered a normal fashion. And so when he had these moments, they were usually moments of extreme frustration over something. And I think that that's a reaction that some people have when they're finding they're not being understood. And so that his reaction was not appropriate. All adults should be able to control their behavior, but nobody can control their feelings, right? So I just saw this as a man who had never had to control his behavior, but was having feelings born of being othered. And that made me sympathize and maybe even a little bit empathize. I don't have a temper at all, but maybe even a little empathize with some of his difficulty communicating in those moments. With regard to the ones where he was denying being unconscious, to me, that's so fascinating that you took it that way, because this guy would report everything. He was super honest. He even had one lab record, and I couldn't find a way to squeeze it in the book, where he was calling himself fat. That was his word for himself. And he was describing how he had to run for the train. And he describes, again, his words, his left breast flapping and how there was pain under it. And so he was like utterly unflinching in describing his own bodily functions as well. So to me, my conclusion from that experiment was that he had severe neurological trauma, not that he was in denial. But right. Yeah, it's interesting that that's how that came across. Yeah.
I love that you have the most compassionate reads of him. I might not be as nice a person because sometimes I'm like, you dang dong, would you stop being so weird? But like, we all are.
That's kind of my general reaction to people in life always. Like, my general reaction is to try and find the compassionate, like, what do we have in common and why is this difficult? But yeah, I think it also may have been different if I had to deal with him in real life.
Right. So, he seems a little like a pill.
Yeah.
I loved, there was one line in the book where I was like, I am in love with this sentence. You describe Haldane and Helen Spurway as the Bonnie and Clyde of clandestine genetics.
I'm glad you love that sentence because, yes, that's in my head. They're like fully outfitted. Like,
perfection. Perfection.
Yeah, again, UCL is closed down and they're like breaking into their experimental rooms to do research with flies.
Like, I love
it's
it.
So awesome.
And obviously, like, their work together bonded them so deeply because their relationship evolves from a professional one and a working relationship to a personal one. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I feel like they were just a really unique couple in the sense that they both had difficulty processing social regulars, like social mandates and social norms. And I think that was a big part of why they were such a tightly knit couple, almost from the moment they met. So I mentioned earlier that JBS Haldane had been married when they met, but his marriage had already been a bit sour and they didn't have a conventional marriage to begin with. There's some indication that they were openly polyamorous even at that time. But in the 1930s, obviously, this was not socially acceptable. So when he met Helen Spurway and they have this incredible bond over genetics, I kind of loved that for them.
Yeah.
I was cheering them on because as someone who has like delighted in having conversations at 3 a.m. about inflammatory pathways in the liver, like I just really wanted that experience for somebody else. And that plus their slight disconnect from society and the way to communicate made me feel like the two of them really connected over things that were fundamentally important to the both of them.
I also couldn't help but wondering if there's like a degree of almost trauma bond with them at that point. Like they have been through like secret science during the Blitz. They are part of a really groundbreaking thing that they never get to talk about. You know, they just have like a unique thing where no one on earth understands me but you, and you understand all of it.
They both went through their entire lives just like being really, really othered. JBS Haldane, because of his temper. So that part is slightly deserved, but his temper, in my opinion, was from difficulty communicating with other people. And then Helen Spurway, a lot of it was really gendered. A lot of the comments and reactions to her were very, very gendered. And she similarly just has this passion where all they ever wanted to do was go to lab and do statistics on fruit flies, study genetics. And they both are just like, I don't understand why there's so many obstacles. But yeah, they both had their work stolen from them because people didn't like them, things like that. So yeah, I would completely agree with you. I think there's elements of trauma bonding, both from surviving the war and also from the way that they interacted with the rest of humanity.
Here's the million-dollar question.
Ooh.
If you could choose just one thing for readers to take away from this book, what would it be? I know it's hard because this is a book dense with information and cool stories.
It's actually not that hard. I was taking a deep breath because I have thoughts.
You're like, I'm just shifting gears, baby.
Yeah, no, I know. This book started because I wanted to write a book about scientists experimenting on themselves. So my original idea was a compilation of multiple stories. And my agent, Lori Apkemeyer, who's amazing and always right, she was like, no, people will lose track one story to the other. Pick one, focus on that. So that's what happened here. And the reason that I wanted to write that book, which didn't happen, and this book, which did, is because I wanted to give people a window into the humanity behind scientific results. That's what I want people to take away. We're people, we're imperfect, we're genuinely doing our best. We're moving things forward whenever we can. Sometimes we get bombed, sometimes we get run out of funding. That all impacts research. So every piece of scientific data, every recommendation that comes out, like there's a story of humanity behind it. That's what I want.
I'd love it. Was there anything else you wanted to share or talk about related to this that we haven't touched on?
I can't think of anything really. I think you've done a really good job of letting me prattle on about these people and how awesome they were.
Are you kidding? That's not prattling. That's like, yeah. You know.
I just want to emphasize again, like this book was important to me because as Americans, we think about World War II as Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. Yeah. And then a time warp occurs. D-Day, June 6th, 1944. I'm like, that's kind of, I'm guilty of this too. But that's sort of the history version we always get. And so this book is kind of my answer to what happened in between. Why did it take 3 years? What happened in between? What was life like? What were people working on? What did we do with that time to make D-Day possible and save as many lives as we could?
Oh, it's such a good read. I highly recommend for anybody. Chamber Divers is out now. Pretty much wherever you can get a book, there it is.
Yeah. Please support local bookstores if you're able.
Yes.
If you're not able, libraries are great too. Libraries actually are a way to support authors. There is a system there.
Yes. So. And we just love a library. So
yes,
also
big library fan.
There are cool, great people at the library. So go there. Dr. Rachel, just seems like a funny way to call you Rachel. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. I feel so spoiled that
you.
I get a whole hour of science and science gossip with you.
Well, I'll be really honest, Holly. I'll talk about science for hours to the wall. So, you know, yeah.
Thanks again to Dr. Rachel Lance. And that book, once again, is called Chamber Divers. If any of the things that she talked about in today's episode piqued your interest, there's so much more of it in the book. And that's available now.
Yeah. And be ready to read some things that may or may not make you a little bit squeamish, but also impressed, terrified, and way more informed about how we have learned about pressure and the human body. I have some listener mail that I don't think will scare anybody. This is about our Margaret Knight episode, and it is from a listener also named Margaret, who writes, I often listen to the podcast while I work on craft projects, and I just happened to be listening to the Margaret Knight episode while I was threading my loom. Yes, as you said in the podcast, people do still hand weave on looms, including myself. I have a smallish 4-shaft loom that I make towels, scarves, and fabrics for sewing. The shuttles I use are pointed and would probably be a bit painful if you got hit by one flying toward you, but you would have to be extremely unlucky to be hit hard enough for an injury. I do throw the shuttle with some vigor. My weaving instructor said if your shuttle never comes flying out the end, you're not throwing it hard enough. The worst that has ever happened with my loom is the shuttle goes clattering to the floor. I really enjoy the podcast and look forward to it every week. For pet tax, I'm attaching pictures of my pups Buzz and May. Both are named after astronauts. Okay, first of all, astronaut dogs, I'm here for all of it. Second of all, these puppies are so cute. They are little cobby angels. And I want to kiss their faces.
No.
They just both look so hilarious and adorable. And they're clearly like, these are some good pet portraits that maybe were taken at like an Easter situation or a springtime thing. They're surrounded by flowers. They look like such good babies. Oh, Buzz and May, you need some hugs and kisses. So hopefully Margaret will give you some pets and loves from us. Thank you for that. It's one of those things, I have known people that loom their own stuff, but I don't know very much about the process. And I have never heard about you have to throw your shuttle.
It can be a long way to get it from one side to the other.
Right. Yeah. I've only done teeny tiny little projects on baby versions of looms that are, they're real in the sense that they're physical things that exist in the world, but they're not real looms. So that's a good bit of insight, and also, obviously safer than the automated ones that caused Margaret Knight to have to figure out a way to make a safety mechanism to prevent her coworkers from getting horribly injured.
Right.
So Margaret, who wrote us, thank you for your email. If you would like to write us, you can do so at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can also find us on social media as Missed in History. And if you have not subscribed to the show yet, that is easy as pie to do. You can do that on the iHeartRadio app or anywhere you listen to your favorite shows.
Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.